the situation and with Syriza, and also connected to the euro crisis. So we invited a friend, Pavlos. He lives in Berlin, but he's from Greece originally. And he will do a presentation for, I don't know, like 30, 40 minutes or something?
Maximum
that. And then there will be time for for discussions. And it will be, today it will be in English. And if that is fine for all, it's good. If you want to like ask a question, don't want to formulate yourself in English, you can ask us to help you translate, if necessary. I think that's about it. Now it's, so I leave to you, Pavlos. And we will actually make a sound recording. I hope it's fine with you.
Okay, so hello. Hi, thanks for coming. And thanks for inviting me here. I'm gonna try and do a presentation about particularly about Syriza, the situation in Greece, and the continuation of the crisis. And the focus is on Syriza because for the last few months there's been quite a lot of enthusiasm and great expectations on behalf of the left, internationally and to a certain extent in Greece, about Syriza. But 4 months after the victory of Syriza, it has become clear that things are not the way people thought they would be. And the enthusiasm has kind of faded away. And Syriza has not, and it's becoming more and more obvious that it will not fulfill its like pre-election promises or become the solution that everybody thought was going to be. And the real question I think I'm going to try and answer is why. And in the discussions among the left internationally, a lot of people are explaining this failure as a result of the very intransigent attitude of the Eurozone, the no negotiation policies of primarily Germany, as they say, but generally the Eurozone members. Others claim that Syriza did not push hard enough. This is, for example, the left wing of Syriza. And that the question is to return to a point where Syriza is an expression of the movement as it was in the beginning. And I think both these explanations of the failure are problematic, but in order to understand why, we need to take a close look at the, first of all, the relationship between Syriza and the movement, second of all, the actual program that Syriza had, and to situate this in the context of the crisis in the Eurozone. So I will start with Syriza and the movement, and to begin there, I would like to explain, first of all, what exactly we mean by movement against austerity in Greece. And by explaining that, I'm hoping to clarify what Syriza's relation to that was. And so when we talk about the movement, we're talking about a period of time of around 2.5 years from the beginning of May 2010, when the Troika bailout agreement was made, the memorandum, until roughly the mid of 2012. I would call February 2012, the last general strike, as kind of like the farewell party of the movement. In this period of 2.5 years, approximately, there were unprecedented mobilizations in Greece, even for a country like Greece that has a very strong tradition of mobilizations that included both traditional forms of resistance, like general strikes, demonstrations, riots, and all that, plus new forms of movement resistance, which would mean things like the squares movement, the non-payment campaigns, the neighborhood assemblies, and looting of supermarkets, and other characteristics. At the same time, the whole movement was characterized by a very strong increase of a delegitimization of political process, the considering of the political class in Greece as responsible for the situation, and a gradual delegitimization. Lastly, you have a very increased mobilization in relation to immigrants and fighting against the the emergence of neo-Nazis. As any social movement, in contrast, for example, to a political movement, the movement in Greece was quite contradictory. So it included people who did not want to change their lives at all, who were quite happy in the way things were in the past. It included people who just fought to resist the devaluation of their lives, and people who saw this opportunity given by the crisis as a way to bring forward proletarian needs as against those of capital. A way of portraying this contradiction in the movement is to look at the coexistence of cross-class alliances and class perspectives. These two things coexisted during the movement, and it created a kind of problematic dynamic in many cases. So, for example, the cross-class alliance you saw in certain parts of the movement was a very good ground to adopt a kind of national politics, you know, to understand the crisis as something which is done against Greece as a nation, to understand the crisis as a way of destroying the national sovereignty of the Greek government and the Greek people, to see austerity as a discipline mechanism towards Greeks in particular, and the similar attitudes. At the same time, the class perspective was kind of on the other side of that and was trying to, in the best of cases, let's say, put proletarian needs at the forefront and not accept this national discourse. These contradictions were fought throughout the movement. And it's not, I wouldn't say it's exaggeration to say that the practical expressions of the movement in the end were moving closer and closer towards its radical aspects and not the other way around. But the problem is that the movement lost. It was defeated. And I don't want to go too much into details on that, but I want to explain the failure on the basis of like three main reasons. The first was like the kind of obvious decisiveness on behalf of the state to push through austerity at whatever cost. It became quite clear after a point that the powers that were managing the situation in Greece would use any means in order to make sure that austerity would keep going. So the level of repression of the movement was very, very strong and cannot be avoided. At the same time, it shouldn't be the failure of the movement shouldn't be explained simply on the level of repression. We also have to look at the fact that the political class and the government in Greece, or the governments, showed themselves to be extremely flexible in changing their, or sacrificing certain key parts of the apparatus in order to maintain the austerity. So, for example, a good example would be that PASOK, the leading party which initiated the bailout agreement with the Troika. When we say PASOK in Greece, we're talking about the key state mechanism of Greece of the last 25 years. They controlled basically the state mechanism. PASOK is now literally destroyed. It does not exist as it was before. It hardly made it into parliament in the last elections, and it seems to, it wouldn't be a surprise if in the next election they don't even get in parliament. This was something that was like unimaginable, like a year before the crisis, the disappearance of PASOK. What was also unimaginable was the fact that PASOK would make a coalition government with New Democracy in order to maintain the austerity measures. For anyone who has grown up in Greece since, at least in my generation, since like the 70s onwards, the conflict between New Democracy and PASOK was what characterized the Greek society. And they had like very bitter conflicts in between. Of course, at a political level and not at a very substantial level. But at the same time, that was another thing that was unimaginable, to imagine that PASOK and New Democracy would form a coalition. They did. Other parties also joined these coalitions. Even now, the coalition between Syriza and the independent Greeks is something that a lot of people find very hard to digest, because the independent Greeks are nationalist, homophobic, anti-Semitic party, and it comes as a surprise to left-wing people, especially outside of Greece, to understand how this coalition happened. I think the way to see it is that, in a way, the need to continue, or the inability to stop the austerity program, means that any kind of possible way was tried out in Greece. So this flexibility was quite important in understanding how they were able to resist the force of the movement. And the third reason of the failure would be what I mentioned before, the contradictory character of the movement, which in certain cases meant that a decisive step forward was not done in a very... there are moments in social movements where you have the opportunity to take a step and reach a point of no return, let's say. In order to do that, a more clear unity about what you're asking for has to be achieved, and that was not achieved. So in certain key moments of the movement, this step forward was not made because of the contradicting elements within it. So the movement failed, and in this context, the February 2012 general strike was kind of like the farewell party, because soon after it became clear that the movement was unable to fight back. After all these different things were tried out and tested, people really fought hard to create conditions that would stop the austerity, and we didn't even manage to win 50 euros back. You know, it's as simple as that. So this sense of defeat was quite important, and it determined the continuation of the situation. Most of the characteristics of the movements that I said stopped existing more or less after the mid of February. You can see, for example, in between May 2010 and February 2012, there were, if I'm not wrong, around 23 general strikes called. Since February 2012 until today, there's only been one. So this is just an indication of how much the intensity in the first period, and how much the movement has completely receded in the second part. But also in other sectors, the neighborhood assemblies, the other kind of expressions of the movement were also gradually withdrawing from... Okay. What happens when social movements lose, quite often in history, is that there is a return to politicization. And what I mean is a return to political identities. And you saw that quite clearly. For example, the neighborhood assemblies, although they started off as meeting points for people to address social issues, so they would, for example, meet up and try to deal on a neighborhood level with issues of poverty, with electricity being cut and trying to reconnect it. They were addressing those issues. After the, the turning point being February 2012, after that you could see that the neighborhood assembly started disintegrating, and what you had is different political identities fighting each other in that terrain instead of addressing those social issues. A lot of people were really tired after a while. General strikes are very effective means to the extent that you actually gain something. Otherwise, they're just draining people's resources. People could no longer afford to lose wages as they do in strikes. And at the same time, in this process of repoliticization that I mentioned, the emergence of neo-Nazis played a significant part in that, because neo-Nazis were conceived as a political threat, as a political identity, and the response to that was the creation of an Antifa political identity. I'm not going to... That'd be great, thanks. I'm not exactly criticizing that, but I'm saying to a certain extent it was necessary to deal with the neo-Nazi threat. At the same time, it marked a very clear difference in relation to dealing with social issues and the issues created by the crisis, and dealing with a political problem like neo-Nazis. The return to politicization eventually meant a return to an acceptance of the parliamentary road. Okay, and since people were tired and defeated and believed that what they had done in a kind of practical level as a movement failed, they saw that the last hope might be the election of a party like Syriza that would that promised to bring back austerity. I'm saying all this to explain that the victory of Syriza in the elections was not a result of the continuation of the movement, as a lot of people say. It has to be seen as an expression of the defeat of the movement. So the movement was like defeated, it lost its momentum, it stopped existing as a practical expression of a kind of negative attitude towards the devaluation. And then it became like the last hope became something like, okay, maybe Syriza might have a chance to take some things back. One of the common things that people said during the election time when Syriza won in January was that even if Syriza does 1/10 of what it says in its program, that would be enough in relation to what we've experienced in the last 5 years. So this is quite a significant point, because also Syriza uses that argument today to explain the fact that it has withdrawn from its program, to say, okay, even 1/10 of what was said would have been enough. The explanation I've made here of like this narrative of like Syriza as being the result of the defeat of the movement is also important when dealing with another critique that has appeared in the radical scene, that Syriza is a recuperation force that like recuperates elements of the movement in order to to assimilate the kind of, you know, resistance against what is happening. This is not a very valid argument, for the simple reason that there is not much left to recuperate. You do not have a movement at the moment which is like actively like threatening the situation. You haven't had that for at least 2 years. So Syriza is not actually recuperating something. If it was, that would mean that you would have, you know, some actual threat on the ground. This has not been the case. People have like withdrawn after the failure. So Syriza became the embodiment of hope because everything else failed. And as a reformist / opportunist party, and I mean these terms in a descriptive way, not necessarily in a kind of slagging off way, what Syriza did is exactly what makes reformism like strong in every kind of situation. It promised everything to everyone. It had like this very minimal agreement that the main enemy is this abstract notion of like austerity or memorandum. This minimal agreement on this very abstract level explains why they could like make a coalition with the independent Greeks without that creating a lot of problems. And in basic terms, what Syriza did is like regenerate this idea that the state can act as a mediation that protects like the citizens from the abstract forces of the economy. So we have this return of the idea that the state can act in the middle and protect like the people from the effects of the crisis. And this is what Syriza brought back. If we see it like that, we can understand how far Syriza is from the actual movement before, because as I said, the movement before was actively like and continuously threatening the legitimacy of the political class. Now the question I'm going to turn to is like why did Syriza fail? And in order to explain that, I need to make a very brief explanation or analysis, an attempt at analysis at the Eurozone crisis in itself. When the crisis started in the Eurozone, it affected different countries in different ways. The reason for these differences has to do with the fact that the monetary union, the Eurozone, was from the beginning created on the basis of very structural differences. So what you had is like you had a north in which you had like export-led countries that were doing like really well with a high-level, high-tech industrial sector. Primarily based on exports, and that would be like Germany, Holland, France, and they had like very strong industrial output that benefited from a common currency that was kept very stable and devalued in relation to the previous currency. And on the south, more or less, okay, you had Ireland as well, but Ireland's kind of an exception. On the south, you had less developed, non-competitive export industries, which basically relied on cheap interest rates and financialization. This was more or less the situation in the Eurozone before the crisis. So you had like two different regimes of accumulation, one of the export industrial strong countries and the ones in the south that would only sustain themselves through loans, and they would fund like their growth on the basis of loans they received because of the cheap interest rates. So long as things were going well, at least before the crisis hit, nobody complained about the structural differences. Everybody was kind of happy. But when the crisis hit, and it hit the financial sector very particularly, the countries that depended on credit were basically crippled. They could no longer sustain this form, this regime of accumulation. In the case of Greece, there was like a very, very high state debt. And the inability of the state to repay this debt meant that it was excluded from the market. It could not borrow any more money. So the precondition for the bailout agreement to happen was that the state debt was used as a leverage in order to impose austerity policies. So in order for Greece to keep getting some money from the European Union, they would have to impose this austerity. Now, the result of the austerity in the last 5 years is like devastating. I don't want to get too much into details, but I would give you some numbers just to get an idea, because it's sometimes not that easy to understand the extent. So, for example, unemployment in Greece has gone up to 27%. It was like 12% in 2010. It has like more than doubled, and it's primarily hitting young people. So for people between 17 and 25, the unemployment rate is 60%. Wage cuts across the public sector have been around 40%, and the private sector is only slightly lower, 25% of the wages have been lost. But already the private sector, the wages were lower than the public sector. So the difference in actual real wages is like almost the same. Small businesses, which is like the backbone of the Greek economy, you have to consider that 95% of businesses in Greece consist of less than 10 workers. So, they have been completely devastated by the crisis. That was, in fact, the destruction of small businesses was part of the first memorandum agreement. Europe was like reacting to the very low concentration of capital in Greece. So more than 250,000 businesses have been closed in the last few years as a result of these policies. And you have a very dramatic cuts in the budget of welfare, such as health or education. Like, especially in health, the budget for the health system has been cut down by 25%. And that practically means that a lot of hospitals have closed down, a lot of hospitals are completely understaffed, and that has created like really huge problems in terms of like health issues. Just to give you an example, like a friend's father wasn't diagnosed with cancer until it was like too late, because they did not have the equipment to do it in hospital. And I'm not talking about some really poor proletarian case. This was like kind of middle class professional. They did not have access to a health system that could have prevented that. So these are like the very clear results. In total, the GDP loss in Greece is like 25%. And the debt, which was like the reason why the whole thing started, has like increased massively. From 120% when in 2010, that was considered like non-viable, it is now 176% of GDP. So it's like increasing all the time. And contrary to official statements that you had before Syriza was elected, there was no growth. There was this like idea that there was an exit to the markets and some surplus creating the budget. That was completely manipulated statistics with the agreement of the European Union, because the need was to kind of present. Even Germany agreed that they changed the way they calculated like surplus for Greece specifically, and they did that because they wanted to show, okay, that austerity is not only bad, and they also did it to help the government of Samaras, the previous government, to have some kind of political legitimacy. So they created this fictional surplus increase plus an exit to the market, but that was like ridiculous. When the actual numbers came out, Greece still has a 3 billion deficit, no surplus whatsoever. Okay, so this is like the background of the situation, and this is where Syriza comes in. And Syriza gets elected with like four key points in its program. The one is what Syriza calls to deal with the humanitarian crisis, kind of what I explained before. The choice of words is very specific. When you talk about humanitarian crisis, it sounds a bit like, okay, it's more like a philanthropic, like, you know, the state has to take care of, like, you know, those poor people. It's not really seen, I mean, it wouldn't because it's Syriza, but it's not like a class perspective, like, okay, what are the opportunities for proletarians in a crisis? It's more like, okay, we have this like sector of the population which is really bad and the state has to take care of them. But anyway, I will get into that a bit more later. The main points, so, would be the dealing with the humanitarian crisis, an attempt to regenerate growth in the economy, a democratic restructuring of the state, basically dealing with issues like corruption and the tax system, and the debt reduction. These are the main points of Syriza's program. And it sounds kind of okay, but as soon as you look at the details, it is not even that grandiose as a program, even for a Keynesian, from a Keynesian perspective. The main arguments, the program of Syriza, what is called the Thessaloniki program, that was announced in September 2014, in relation to the humanitarian crisis, just in order to explain, was saying things like electricity is going to be reconnected for 300,000 families, food vouchers are going to be given to 300,000 families, there will be like housing for all, there would be support for low-income pensioners, there would be a restructuring of the tax system, an immediate stop to foreclosures, like taking away the main house of a family, the abolition of a recent heavy tax on property, the writing off of debts that could not be repaid, the so-called toxic debts, the increase of the minimum wage, a return to collective bargaining, and the creation of 300,000 new jobs, adding 300,000 new people to unemployment benefits, stuff like that. 300,000 was like the favorite number of Syriza because they kept, you know, every kind of measure included like 300,000. And in the end, you started thinking maybe they're talking about the same 300,000 people who are going to get like different parts. But anyway, the idea was, even with such a program, which if you look at it, it's quite minimal, and I want to explain that. For example, the increase of the minimum wage, okay, that sounds like a very interesting and kind of decent measure. It actually only affects 10% of the workforce. It is not that widespread as people believe. And in fact, it also applies to people who have part-time jobs, in which case the actual increase would be like really something like 10-20 euros a month. It would be something as low as that. It sounds like a, you know, big plan, but if you look at the actual numbers, it doesn't mean a lot. The reconnection of electricity and food vouchers and stuff, it was announced as a plan like that, but if you looked at the details, you would see that it only applied to specific cases and the family had to provide like a tax record and show that they're actually, you know, eligible to apply for that. So it had a number of restrictions. In the end, even after a lot of like negotiations, the actual number of people who would benefit from some of these schemes was cut down to 30,000. This is like in the process of the negotiations of Syriza with the Troika. Nonetheless, this was the program that they had in mind. This is what more or less they got elected for. And the question is, from the beginning, like what is the cost of such a program and where would Syriza get the money? That was the real question. And according to Syriza's own calculations, which could be disputed, but I will accept them for the moment, the cost was around 12 billion. Okay, this is like the main cost of their like ambitious Keynesian, let's say, program. So the question is, how is Syriza going to get the money for that? Their plan was, in the beginning, was to do a kind of debt restructuring, to cut like part of the debt, which would allow the government to use any future surplus towards the economy and not towards repaying loans. And the other hope they had was that they would be included in the quantitative easing program of the ECB, which basically means that the Greek government could issue state bonds, the ECB would buy them, and then Greece could like fund its like government could fund its program through the sale of state bonds. Quite quickly, it became clear that none of these two would work. Greece was not included in the quantitative easing program of the ECB, and the state of the debt restructuring was not even in the agenda of the negotiations. The reason for that is quite simple, because if Greece does not have this huge state debt, or if it can handle the debt through the sale of new bonds, there is no leverage through which to impose austerity in Greece anymore. The mechanism they use to impose austerity is exactly the existence of this debt. So either a debt restructuring or the sale of like state bonds would eliminate this leverage that they have. And it's pretty clear that the state debt of Greece is quite important, because it has like a twofold character. Everyone knows it's not going to be repaid. Greece is like never going to be in a position to repay the. I can show you a little graph if it's just to demonstrate this point. I don't know if you can see it. Maybe. Okay, for those who can see it, like the blue line here is what the primary balance would be in order to repay the debt, okay? The gray line next to it is what the average actual primary balance has been for the last 60 years, okay? So the first one is Greece. In order for Greece to be able to repay its debt, it would have to increase its primary, like, four times more than it has ever been in the last 60 years in Greece. Okay, and there's like other countries, but this is like the main point. It is like impossible for Greece to repay its loans, and everybody knows that. But it doesn't matter, because to the extent that you keep have this this state debt, you can use it as a means of implementing austerity. Now, When Syriza started the negotiations, they Varoufakis, this like famous finance minister, he used a very specific strategy, which was kind of smart in the beginning. His idea was to throw everything out on the table. Okay, so against this idea of like discussing behind closed doors and making agreements and then just announcing them, he just came out and said things more or less how they were. So he said Greece cannot repay its debt, and that's final. And everybody knows that. So let's not stop pretending that they can pay the debt, and try to figure out a way in which, like, you know, we can do something else. That was his main strategy. At the same time, whether this was like a good strategy or not, it doesn't really matter, because the point is, Syriza did not have any means of imposing its own program in the negotiations. It didn't have any leverage against Europe. The only thing they could hope for, and this is like my understanding of the series of negotiations so far, is that either that the European partners would show goodwill and accept this program, or that they would make some kind of alliances with other like parts of Europe in order to achieve this. No allies were found in Europe, and that's quite easy to explain, and I'm kind of like a bit surprised that Syriza even thought that they would find allies, because the main allies that they could find would obviously be other countries that have been hit by austerity, maybe not as much, but like also have been hit, like Portugal, Spain, and in all these countries what you have now is governments who are trying to stay in power against political parties like Syriza, like Podemos in Spain, you have like the Izquierda party in Portugal. So you have like the development of these forces which are still in opposition, and then the actual governments of these countries would like rather commit suicide than accept a kind of deal for Greece that would allow those parties to increase their influence. So no allies were found, and the hope that the other hope that European partners would show goodwill, I have to say, it was not entirely crazy. It was based on this idea that Syriza's actual program was very minimal, and in order to have some stability in Greece in relation to the past 5 years, it would have been possible, and I also thought it was possible in the beginning, that the Eurozone members would allow Syriza to implement small part of this program in exchange for providing some kind of stability. And in a way, it made sense. It's like this continuing this strategy that they have so far in the Eurozone crisis of extend and pretend. Let's just like pretend that the problem is not here. Let's do something for the short-term period, and then we'll deal with it in the future. And everybody's basically holding their breaths, hoping that it's not going to blow up in their face. But this has been the strategy so far. And I think Syriza had this idea that, okay, our program sounds pretty cool for the people in Greece, but in actual fact, it's quite a minimal program. So in that sense, it shouldn't be so hard for Europe to accept it and pretend that, okay, we pretend that we're giving Syriza some time and Syriza is pretending to fight against austerity, whereas in reality, you have some form of continuation. That didn't work either. Europe was not interested in that. Eurozone officials, on the one hand, I think they saw that any kind of like goodwill towards Syriza would create, would give an impression of leniency to other governments as well. And that would create a kind of spiral in southern countries that might also adopt a kind of similar attitude towards a more Keynesian kind of way of managing the crisis. And maybe Greece in itself is not that important, and it's like the cost of its program was not that big in relation to the money that's been circulating in the Eurozone. But at the same time, if other countries with more important GDPs were influenced, then that would change the situation quite a lot in Europe, in the Eurozone. So I think they really tried to avoid that. And I think they also objected to the fact that Syriza's Keynesian program was based, in a way it's kind of funny, but like it was based on the continuation of the bailout. Because the money that was going to be, where Syriza was going to find in order to implement its program, was the money that they receive now as bailout mechanism. They actually, when the negotiations were happening and the Eurozone, the ECB threatened to cut like the ELA mechanism, which is like the emergency liquidity assistance mechanism for the banks. Syriza members, especially left wing, fought against that, and they basically admitted that the money that was going to go for the banks was going to be used for their program. So it was pretty clear that Syriza hadn't thought very well on how to sell this kind of like situation, and the fact that they presented themselves also all around as like the response, the long-awaited response to austerity, made it even worse at this level of political representation, because the rest of Europe thought, okay, if this is the beginning, then it's going to spread to other places, and that's not something that they want. So this is more or less, I would say, the reasons why Syriza's program failed. And to be sure that they have failed, I think it's kind of worth me reading out the latest article that Varoufakis wrote in relation to the negotiations where they are at the moment. And I'm just going to read a small part for people to understand. So he says, a common fallacy pervades coverage by the world's media of the negotiations between the Greek government and its creditors. The fallacy is that Athens is unable or unwilling, or both, to implement an economic reform program. The reality of the talks, he says, is very different. Our government is keen to implement an agenda that includes all of the economic reforms emphasized by European think tanks. Moreover, we are uniquely able to maintain the Greek public support for a sound economic program. Consider what that means. Okay, this is like an independent tax agency, reasonable primary fiscal surpluses forever, a sensible and ambitious privatization program, combined with a development agency that harnesses public assets to create investment flows, genuine pension reform that ensures that social security system's long-term sustainability, and a liberalization of markets for goods and services. Like, this is what, like, the Syriza's finance minister says about the situation. He's basically accepting all of the memorandum measures while pretending that this is like part of Syriza's program. It's like, it's quite insane to read it like that, but this is the reality. On a general level, and I'm kind of coming close to an end, what Syriza suggested was not simply a way of dealing with a crisis in Greece. They suggested, and Varoufakis made it clear quite often, that their proposal for the solution that they were proposing was good for the whole of Europe. So they were basically proposing a restructuring of the whole Eurozone in a way that manages the crisis in a more sort of Keynesian direction. So the idea was like what Varoufakis called the surplus recycling mechanism, which means that countries that have surpluses in their economy, like Germany and Holland and these places, would invest the surplus towards the south, towards the economies that do not have the same competitiveness in their economy. So his idea was kind of recycling of surpluses within the Eurozone in order to help those which are not in a position to compete on the international market. But as I said before, this is kind of a weird Keynesian conception, because it's Keynesian on the hand that the state intervenes in order to create jobs and, you know, provide some kind of security, but at the same time the money is still credit. It is still based on some kind of, like, you know, giving out credit from the European Union. So it's a kind of like weird conception of Keynesianism that obviously Europe and the dominant forces in Europe have absolutely no time for. And Greece, like Syriza, had absolutely no leverage to impose any kind of change like that. The only thing that Syriza could have used in order for even part of this program to be accepted would be to threaten to actually leave the Eurozone. This was the only possibility that they had. They chose not to do that. And to a certain extent, it's like understandable, because a Grexit, what we call an exit of Euro, of Greece from the Euro, would have devastating results for the Greek economy, at least to a certain extent. And I'm not going to go into details of that. We can discuss about it. If people are interested in the Grexit, I can give you some kind of basic analysis of what it would mean. But for the time being, let's just say that this was the only thing that could actually be used against Eurozone officials, and Syriza quite clearly decided not to do that. So Syriza found itself in a position where it has no negotiation plan. They're basically in a corner where they say, okay, we have to remain in the Eurozone, the majority of the population in Greece wants to remain in the Eurozone, the only way to remain in the Eurozone is to continue the existing program. The final question is, like, I want to address a little bit, is like whether the failure of Syriza is a sign of some kind of German hegemonic, if Germany has this hegemonic role that it's been given. And this is becoming an interesting, like a difficult but interesting question, especially because in Greece now you have the development of a very strong anti-German, and I would say slash nationalist, discourse. For the first time in the last 6 years, although there was always this kind of like Germany is like the leading enemy, there has never been a demonstration outside the German embassy as it was last week. This is the first time this has ever happened, and it shows a kind of like change in the discourse in Greece, and it increases, in my opinion, this kind of nationalist understanding. Now, I don't want to get too much, I think maybe this is like not too interesting for people, but I would like just briefly to say that the question of Germany being a hegemonic power in this thing is kind of problematic. One reason that Germany is seen like that is because the whole Eurozone crisis is understood as a crisis between debtors and creditors. To the extent that this is the understanding of the crisis, then the ones who are giving out the credit are the ones who have a leading role in determining what are the rules for giving out this credit. So in that sense, to the extent that we understand the crisis like that, Germany, of course, has a leading role because Germany is the strongest economy at the moment in the Eurozone. So they are giving out more money, in a sense, as loans than anyone else. But the main reason, the main way I would say to understand the position of Germany is the simple fact that Germany is the only country that has managed to bounce back from the crisis faster than anyone else. Germany had a very drastic drop in their economic output in between 2007 and 2008, but it immediately bounced back, and in five economic quarters, the German economy is booming again. And the reason they did that was that they focused a lot on exports, and they focused on markets that have very high demand, let's say. I'm not going to get into that. But the fact that Germany has managed to survive the crisis in such a way means that all other countries in Europe are looking at Germany as a model to be followed. And this is the main reason. So it's not so much that Germany is not forcing anyone to follow a specific policy. It's more like everyone else agrees that this kind of policy of austerity is the only way to get through the crisis. And of course, for Greece specifically, it might mean a kind of complete devastation of the population, but that's not the issue at stake at all. This is not what they're interested in. They're interested in a way of managing the crisis that retains some kind of stability in the situation, which is very fragile. And Germany seems to be the one providing an answer, and everyone else seems to follow. Because this is quite an important point. To understand Germany as a hegemony is almost implying that other countries would like to do something else, but they are forced, or they have no way of convincing. This is not the case. There hasn't been any kind of disagreement with Germany's policies so far, even in relation to Greece, but also in relation to a general understanding of the quantitative easing or whatever. All 18 members of the Eurozone, with the exception of Greece, agreed with this extension of the program and the continuation of the memorandum. You didn't have any countries coming up and saying, oh no, maybe we should think about it and stuff. There is complete agreement. And I think the key reason for that is because they believe that following the German example is the way to get out of the crisis. So this brings us to the end. I mean, the failure of Syriza is kind of hard to digest, especially from the left. And one of the reasons is that their enthusiasm was based, on what I would say a very wrong reading of what Syriza's actual program was. But it was also based on the fact that after Syriza, they see absolutely no alternative. And it is true that it's hard to imagine what could actually come after Syriza, after the failure is obvious, after the continuation of the program is agreed on. It's very hard to imagine what would come next. And this is quite a difficult thing to digest. If we go back to the beginning and say, okay, Syriza was the last hope of a defeated movement. If Syriza fails too, then what comes next? And this is not a very easy question to answer. At the same time, it's just a fact that this is the situation. And what it means is that, let's put it this way, the unfolding of the crisis so far has, with the exception of things here and there, has provided some kind of stability. It is not long-term, and it's definitely, you can already see that it's cracking in many, many points, because the exact mechanisms that are being used to maintain this stability and to deal with the crisis are generating forces that are moving towards a breakdown of the Eurozone. Okay, and the reason I say this is because since the dealing of the crisis was transformed into a national problem. So like Greece has a problem, Portugal has a problem, Germany is doing its own thing. The whole idea of a monetary union was basically not very effective anymore, and it's not. Every country resorts to its own understanding of like national interests, and this creates like centrifugal forces that are moving away from this conception of the monetary union as a unified thing. A very simple way to understand this is to think of the way the crisis was dealt with in the United States, which is also a kind of monetary union, and the way it was dealt in Europe. And the contrast would be, for example, to think of like when the crisis hit the United States in 2007, it would be something like California declaring bankruptcy and the rest of the United States saying, okay, you can just go fuck yourselves, you know. That would be the equivalent of what, you know, the way that the crisis has been dealt with in Eurozone. And it shows that the way they're dealing with it is completely different, and it is at the expense of specific countries. So that means that all the forces that are appearing now against the crisis, against the management of the crisis, against austerity, are forces that are pushing towards a dissolution of the Eurozone. So what you have is like Le Pen becoming stronger in France with an anti-European agenda. You have Podemos, we have a similar anti-European agenda. The UK is seriously thinking about leaving. So all these like different forces, if you look around, they're pointing towards what I would say, you know, an indication that the Eurozone doesn't have a lot of life left in it. Even Germany, which is like supposed to be the one who's most responsible or interested in maintaining the Eurozone, is doing a number of measures, taking a number of measures internally that break down this idea of a Eurozone. And what I mean, for example, is that in Germany today, they are trying to stop giving out, for example, welfare to Southern Europeans. Right, this is the deal that they have. This they're trying to implement this law, which has already happened in Belgium, that if you come from a European country within Schengen and all that, if you come from a European country into Germany and you don't find a job in 3 months, you could get exported. Right, if you cannot support your own insurance and like pay for yourself, you could be exported. And this is like a way of them protecting like the welfare system, but it also means that one of the fundamental values of the European Union and its monetary union, which is the free movement of labor, is basically radically being dissolved. So you only have like a free movement of capital, but you no longer have the equivalent of a free movement of labor if you put such national restrictions in that. And I think this is the situation that we're looking at the moment. And these are the kind of developments that are happening. Unfortunately, Greece is no longer part of this equation. It's not, in a way, the situation has been dealt with in Greece. I think the sign of a new memorandum agreement is going to be very, very soon. And Greece is not, unfortunately, is no longer a place where an actual movement against this is going to appear for at least some time. So we remain, I would say, from the perspective of like proletarian needs, let's put, we remain caught between two worlds, you know, one which we cannot recognize as it is and one which does not yet exist. And in this process, yeah, it's very hard to be optimistic at the moment, at least for Greece. And that is the end. How long it was? Probably too long.
45 minutes.
More was it 45?
Yeah.
Wow. 50. Sorry for that.
I don't. Yeah,
you want a short break before we start with the discussion?
I'm fine. I wouldn't mind smoking, but if people want to start straight away.
10 minutes. 5 minutes.
5 minutes break. Okay, yeah. So can I have a smoke?
Yes. Okay. The discussion is fine with like moderating as well. Yeah.
Ja,